Too often, survivors of clergy sexual abuse are exiled from telling of their own stories. This must stop. Story Rising is a multiple-day, on-site intensive where survivors have space and resources to reclaim, curate, and share their stories, raising their voices to be heard above the noise. Survivors gather with peers and trained coaches from Hagar's Voice in a trauma-informed space rooted in the beauty of creation. Participants emerge empowered to fully embrace again the main role in their own story. They are strengthened, encouraged, and equipped to heal as their story rises. To learn more, visit hagarsvoice.com/story rising.
Welcome to the Hagar's Voice podcast. I'm so glad you found your way here. We believe the conversations hosted on this channel are important to the future of the church. Hagar's Voice is a network of support for survivors of clergy sexual abuse and a nonprofit advocacy group looking to influence the conversation around abuse in religious spaces. We've created this podcast as a platform for women and men to tell their stories. We see survivors as light bringers, courageous voices helping the church be what she was designed to be. The way we honor their courage to raise their voice is by engaging as students, postured to learn from their experiences and insights and their critique. It's our responsibility and our blessing to be shaped by what we hear here. Listening is an act of solidarity. We bear witness. And as we listen, we learn what it means to be allies. And if we let it, we can be shaped into advocates. Together, we rise to stop the abuse and start building a better way.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to season 2 of the Hagar's Voice podcast and episode 2. I am Angela, your host for today's episode. And as always, I want to begin with a be gentle with yourself reminder. We talk about hard things on this podcast. And there is something inside of you that is drawn to this and that I am cheering on in big ways. I'm so grateful that you're leaning into these hard conversations. But it's also just a kindness from me to you to say, as you're going along, if you find yourself with your sternum clenching up or your tummy going sour or your breathing going shallow, be gentle. You have a pause button and let that pause button be gift. So as we go along, manage, be attuned to your body and be kind. So today, I get the privilege of having a conversation with Alexa Barkley. Alexa, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. We've had many before this, and so I have a little taste of where we're going, but it also feels a little bit like an adventure. And I want to track along with you because in our conversations leading up to this, I have been inspired and touched by your tenacity as a survivor, by your strength, by your vulnerability, by the way that you've interacted with your trauma. But I also have sat in awe of your wisdom and your insight. So I'm really grateful that those conversations are always just you and I. So I'm really grateful to have a record button that's going today. And I just want to go with you where you want to go in this conversation and let other people be blessed by that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I want to say too, like this conversation has been such a long time coming. I think it actually was predestined before Hagar's Voice was a thing. As I started to speak out and then you guys sort of appeared in my purview, it's actually been, I've known this is where we're headed. So I'm very excited about our conversation today.
Yay. Okay, so I know your context and backstory, but maybe before we get to your wisdom and insight, maybe you would be game to share just a little bit of your context so it makes some sense as you give your wisdom and insight. There's a lot of validity to that based on what you've experienced. So would you share just a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, oldest of three, and I was sort of steeped in religion. I was, I would call it the evangelical double whammy in that I was sort of hit with a lot of sort of purity culture and misogyny and patriarchy from the Baptist church that I attended. And then as well, I went to a private Christian school. And so I was sort of being hit from all sides with this same messaging, sort of shame-filled messaging, which actually, because it was pervasive in my life, had me very convinced that I was the problem in everything that had happened. So it's part of the reason why it took so long for me to figure out what had actually happened and that I actually wasn't culpable.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay. No, steeped. I don't like that word, but I really like that word. It is a good picture. I mean, indoctrinated is another word.
And absolutely.
Especially for those of us that were raised, I have a similar story as well of my home life was aligned with my religious community life, which was aligned with my schooling. And right. Friends came from the same echo chamber.
Yes.
So yeah. And in fact, in so many stories, that combo is a grooming for abuse. So
it is. Oh, you don't have a hope because the messaging is consistent across the board that there is something wrong with you specifically. And so, yeah, you really, there's no opportunity for allies. Yeah, you're just absolutely crushed by this sort of faulty doctrine.
Okay, so in the show notes, we're going to link to an article that was done about your story to give that sort of a context. Is there anything that you would like to say about I happen to know that you have a two-layered abuse experience. Is there anything you'd like to say about those two layers?
I just feel like one abuse perpetrated the other. I often find it difficult to communicate the level of sexual violence that I was subject to because I think sometimes the reaction from people is, how could so many bad things have happened to the same person? But what ends up happening, and I found out more in my adult life by talking to other survivors, is actually perpetrators will use the fact that you are damaged or you have had past experiences of sexual violence to not only victimize you, but then actually they will use that to cover up their crime as well. So I was sort of doomed just by the level of violence that I experienced in my life.
Oh, gosh. I bear witness to that. I think there are parts of that are in my own story. I have at times looked back in what feels breathtaking at the various versions of abuse coming from various contexts and different shapes of relationships. But I can look back at it now as an adult who understands the ecosystems of abuse. And I can see several things that were at play that make that one leads to the other, leads to the other, leads to the other, and one permissions the other. And the further you get into that cycle as a victim, like we generally refer to victims as survivors. And in Hagar's voice, we think about survivors as light bringers who are bringing light into these dark places. But in this context, as we talk about this, it's a victim being victimized again, being victimized again. It further convinces you that all those narratives that you were told about your shame-filled self and your brokenness, you are convinced. Well, I can't speak for you. I was convinced that I was a magnet, that I was just walking around. And actually, I would say that is not untrue. I had a target painted on my back, but the narratives that I had been taught was that I had picked up a sign that said victim target.
Right.
Carrying it around, advertising, you know what I mean? Like, I absolutely agree with the narrative you're calling out about my shame-filled self, thought something was wrong with me, instead of this abusive environment had painted a target on my back and I was easy pickings. And each time I got abused, I was easier to be abused and harder to convince myself that it was abuse.
Right.
Is that's what you're referring to?
Oh, absolutely. And in my case, I'll go into more detail later, but the clergy sexual abuse piece, he was able to use sort of demonic rhetoric. It was just mind twisting bastardization of the Bible against me. And I already believed that all the horrible things he was saying about me were true because I was getting the same messaging from the Christian school. So I really didn't have a hope in all of it.
Jeez. Are you referring to the Jezebel sort of a concept? Is that what you're referring to when you say demonic rhetoric?
So the message was that I was demon possessed or there was demon interference. I was inherently evil. And unfortunately, at the school that I went to was Queensway Cathedral Christian School. And as the amount of violence sort of amplified in my life, and this was sort of during my teen years, my behavior started to spiral a bit. And instead of asking what I needed, protecting me, the school sat me down and asked me if I was the Antichrist. And so when something like that happens to you, especially as a child, then the next bad pastor that comes along and is talking about how you're demon possessed or evil, like you totally buy it. You are now getting this message across the board. Like you literally do not have a hope.
Gosh, when we talk about power dynamics, you know, I listen to your story and I think here's a kid with an adult. You know, even if they're not like an older, mature adult, even if it's a young adult, right, it's adult to them with spiritual and educational backing behind them. The power dynamics are such that that kid would naturally believe their truth or not truth, but like their narrative over their own narrative. But if you repeat that, like if that's not just one adult that's saying that to you, it is insurmountable. How does that kid actually get past this narrative?
Yeah, you can't, because the other piece, so Queensway was particularly bad because the messaging was also that adults were, they had all the answers. They actually spoke for God. And so then you have people, in a position of power telling you something. You trust these people. And so, of course, you're going to believe that these horrible things are true about yourself, which just, I mean, you're so vulnerable at that point. You can't possibly push back, especially as a kid.
Yeah, I had different language for it, but in my own story, I came out of college looking back on a bunch of experiences and realized I actually felt like in the religious stream that I was raised in, the fall of mankind was a common theme, shame. Right. But I had come out of college with a narrative that I was like the poster child for the fallen woman. Right. Like everything that is naturally inside of me was like, it makes their messaging even more, you know, there's the term benevolent patriarchy.
Right.
There is a benevolent spiritual abuse. So the people that came to me, I mean, your story of being asked if you were the Antichrist is unfathomable to me. That what kind of educational and pastoral malpractice is that?
Yeah.
I didn't have anything like that for crying out loud, and no one ever should, but
right.
They came to me out of quote unquote love. They came to me in posture of gentleness, even like, honey, you're just so bad, but we're just trying to help you. We're just trying to help you. So
right.
Benevolent shame.
Right.
Incredibly hard. I mean, as an adult, I struggle with that. When somebody hands me benevolence, I really struggle to. And so, yeah, the kid narrative is impossible.
No, yeah, there is no wrapping your head around that. And it really, that's part of what took me so long to figure out that, I mean, not only was I not the problem in the instances of sexual violence that happened to me, I also am not evil. I am not bad. I'm certainly not the Antichrist. So yeah, but it takes a long time to undo that. That's some serious spiritual damage.
Okay, this is maybe TMI, and you don't have to answer it at all, but are you ever still tempted to believe that about yourself? And if you are, do you have any like common anchor points that you go back to call BS on those things?
Yeah, so I do psychoanalysis, and I think there's that involves a lot of time spent pushing back against that nasty narrative. Yeah. I am better at it now. I can identify when the lies from my childhood are playing into my current day life. But it is a fight every single time to be like, no, like you're actually exactly as Christ wanted you to be. He made you that way. There's nothing evil about you. Like, I actually have to have that narrative in my head and reassure myself consistently, because my whole world for so long had this nasty, nasty messaging associated with it.
Does it work in generic form, like, I am made in the image of God, and that holds water? Or do you have to get down to more specifics of like, no, Alexa is good. Alexa, yeah. Kind. Alexa, like, how can you, do you mind just going into a little bit
more? Yeah. So I think I do have to get a bit more into specifics. I think I also have to prove it to myself to a certain extent. So that was certainly a part of why I wanted to go to the police. And I'll get into that. But I needed external validation that there's nothing bad about me. And I'm one of the lies they would sort of heap upon me was also that I was extremely dishonest and lying about everything, because of course, to get out of, you know, the abuse that they were actually perpetrating, that narrative helps them quite a bit. And so I needed external validation, getting the validation from the judge that here's all the places where the perpetrator is lying, and here's all the places where I can tell that Alexa is telling the truth. Like, that meant a lot to me. And it will, I think that'll keep me going as I sort of push forward and keep trying to convince myself that I'm not the problem.
Wow. Okay. So that's incredibly powerful, because you've just given a 1-2 punch.
Right.
So like, if you can find your own anchor points of truth about who you are, including also external validation and the power of community, because yes, a judge saying that is really validating, and a lawyer saying that is validating, and a pastor saying that is like, there's lots of ways you can get benefit. That kind of validation is just as powerful from your best friend. It's just as powerful, you know, like, it's powerful. But also what I heard in there was, it isn't just a validation of your goodness. It's incredibly important to name the evil that is at play.
Right.
Yes. Like, you can hold this anchor point by both remembering who you are and having a clear bead on what is at play here. And that is evil, and that is wrong, and that's called abuse. Right. And that is a 1-2 punch of holding an anchor point. Mm-hmm. Truth. That's really powerful.
Yeah, I think as well, it's worth, so part of the process has been devaluing some of the voices that I was valuing so much in the past. So there are people that will still to this day think that I'm the problem or I'm a liar. Often it's because they need to maintain that narrative because they've had some sort of culpability in my abuse. But I almost have to set all of that aside. Like, I know they're not going to change their position. And that's okay. I have now surrounded myself with enough people and enough proof that I am actually good, that it doesn't matter so much what those sort of naysayers are saying.
That also is incredibly powerful. And I find myself rooting for survivors in our various conversations. I maybe don't say these words, but my heart is like burgling up. Please dare to believe your own narrative.
Yes.
Yeah, there's just so much gaslighting and grooming and all of these things that have, particularly women, but all survivors, but particularly women, of like, something is wrong with you, you lack humility, you lack whatever, that you would dare to believe that you are good, you are not the problem, and that that is evil, and that is abuse, and that is, that there is this, like, if you adhere to a faith structure, there is a spiritual critique of that kind of courage. And yet in my work, I'm like, I believe you. But it takes incredible courage for a survivor to actually believe their own narrative.
Yeah.
To actually say, I know what was happening inside of me at this time, and it was not what you are saying.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have, you've hinted a couple of things, like, I'll come to that later, and I want to mention those things later.
Okay.
So where do you want to go?
So I guess I'll talk a bit about, we talked about sort of the demonic rhetoric and some of the misogynist type stuff that was playing into my abuse, made it quite so easy for my perpetrator to abuse me. One thing I want to mention as well is just purity culture. I was steeped in that. So purity culture just says that basically you're supposed to refrain from having any sort of sexual interaction until you're in a marriage. It's very shame-laced. If there's any sort of interaction between a male and a female, it's ultimately the female's fault, regardless of whether it was a rape or anything. It ultimately comes down to that particular female is not trying quite hard enough to hide who she is. And so for me, the way that manifested itself during my teen years was I did a lot of work to try to cover myself. Like I would have my hair over my face. I was wearing baggy clothes, a lot of black. It was my attempt to control this, again, sort of like the evil inside, this, you know, evil feminine sexuality kept getting me in trouble.
That breaks my heart.
There are so many of us that are subject to that. I think that's part of why I wanted to speak out, because it's like this nasty narrative that's through so many denominations. It affects so many people, women specifically, because it is quite demeaning for women. And it sets up the perfect scenario for clergy sexual abuse specifically, but also just sexual abuse in general. Yeah. It's gross.
Yeah, I also was steeped in purity culture, and my I didn't have quite such a charitable assumption of the description that you just gave. I maybe have more work to do. But my big takeaway from purity culture is that it is women's responsibility to somehow manage men's sexuality.
Right.
And the only way you can do that is for women to not be sexual. But anyway, there's a whole lot of like play out of that. But when I think about, the visual image that I got of you as a teen covering herself like that, the fear that represents, the fear of self, the fear of men. I mean, this kind of narrative, that's pretty extreme messaging.
Yeah.
That lands like that. But that kind of messaging is so damaging to everyone.
Yeah.
Across the gender spectrum.
Absolutely.
That's really damaging to everyone. And when you say it sets up like the perfect environment in which clergy sexual abuse could grow, that is what I'm referring to when I say the ecosystem of abuse. There are multiple different players that are at effective inside an ecosystem of abuse. And purity culture has not just shaped women.
Right.
Has shaped men. It hasn't just groomed victims. It has groomed abusers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really didn't have a hope. I think a lot of survivors in their scenarios just don't have a hope. The theology sets you up for failure. Yeah.
Thank you for pointing out purity culture. That is a factor at play here. And it's kind of a silent. I don't hear nearly as much conversation in my own deconstruction of this stuff. I have spent quite a bit of time steeping again, but this time in liberation theology that is not shame-filled and all that kind of stuff. But it's not often enough in the conversation around clergy sexual abuse. I really appreciate you bringing that in.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. So as far as my history of sexual violence, specifically, we sort of talked about the environment. So I was raped when I was 13 by my then boyfriend. And that went through the Canadian court systems. That rape teed me up for what happened with my youth pastor, the clergy sexual abuse piece, unfortunately, because I leaned on him to support me through that court process. He absolutely weaponized that. not only in selecting me as his victim, but also after the fact, he was able to sort of use that narrative that I was already sort of damaged or loose or, you know, sexually evil. And so therefore he's the good guy and it can't possibly be his fault.
Well, I would just like to cuss a blue streak.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and even in the current day court process, he tried that again. yeah. So it's, well, yeah. And I think this happens quite regularly, where the perpetrator will sort of point to everywhere but themselves as being the reason that this happened. And so certainly that rape was used against me, in my teens and then again, as an adult in the court process.
Okay. I have to start with, I'm sorry. I've heard your story. I've read your story. I've been around your story, and it just hits so hard. I'm sorry for what you've been through. And I know that's not the end of your abuse story either.
No, unfortunately it's not. Yeah, my heart breaks for little Alexa pretty regularly. I sort of oscillate between, you know, mama bear wanting to decimate everybody who had hurt that little girl. And then, yeah, just in a state of being absolutely heartbroken, not only for the sexual violence, but also for the treatment that I received after my abuse. Yeah, the fact that she did believe that she was the problem. Like, it's just, it's all so sad.
Yeah, you're naming the two emotions that I'm feeling right now, which is like deep lament and regret. That's a funny word to use here, but like,
yeah,
there is this, and then also just rage. I feel so angry that the very people who, like, okay, this stuff happens in life and that is tragic and it shouldn't be normalized and it never should be happening, but it does happen. But then we're supposed to have people in our world, our pastors, our teachers, our parents, our, like, we're supposed right. to have adults in our world that help us traverse this, help us actually travel through the tragedy and come out on the other side.
Yeah.
Somehow more resilient because we understand our value and just how violating this experience was to that value. And the fact that they swung the pendulum to the literal opposite just makes me, decimate is the right word.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd heard somewhere that, sort of the magnitude of trauma that you experience is obviously influenced by whatever the abuse was. But what actually holds more weight is how the people that were around you that were supposed to keep you safe responded. And if they did not respond properly and have your back, then the trauma is just that much more magnified. That's certainly my lived experience.
Yeah. Could we just pull over for a second and say, if you're listening to this and your heart is breaking and angered at the treatment that this young girl received, this young Alexa received, then A, well done on your empathy muscle. That's good. And also, take that same exact sensation and apply that to any adult survivor.
Yeah.
So like, it's really beautiful that you're letting us into your story of a young Alexa. And we're so grateful that you're giving us this path to empathy and understanding and wisdom and hopefully better behavior in our own environments. Mm-hmm. So helpful. But I think we can find our empathy for a kid really, really well. And yet I think we struggle in different ways when we see the grown-up version of this.
Yes.
Not different, you guys.
Right. Not at all.
Different. Abuse is abuse. And no human, no matter how old they are, deserves abuse. And no human, no matter how old they are, is somehow unneeding. That's not right. But finds it unnecessary for the community around them to help them travel through the abuse. So I just, like, you ushered us into this beautiful moment of heartbreak and anger and appropriate just rage.
Right.
Because we can picture this kid who just deserves so much better, but it also gives us the opportunity to recognize where we might have gender biases and things like that that cause us to not have that same response when it is an adult survivor of clergy sexual abuse. So rattle down, but as my heart was breaking for this kid, that should be our response to any human. This is not how
absolutely. And for abuse in general, but I think it's specific to clergy sexual abuse. So the reason I think our heart is sort of more apt to break with children is because it's easy for us to see those power divides. Like obviously one was an adult and one was a child. I think where it's more difficult is for people to see the power divides that exist between clergy and adults. And they are significant as well. Just so much harder to see.
Yeah. But I also think we have this narrative about kids that they're innocent. So I don't know what the blankety blank the people in your world were doing with kids. Like,
yeah. Ooh.
But in general, our narrative about kids are innocent and they don't deserve this. Like there's this rage rises up of like, how dare you treat an innocent kid like this? How dare you? But I if we find ourselves more engaged emotionally with a kid than we do adult, it begs the question, like, at what age does someone deserve to be mistreated like this?
Right.
What's happening in our anime? It just seems important. It's just like, yeah, let's just note, at every age, humans deserve protection. At every age, humans are sacred. At every age, power dynamics can be at play. Like, that's a brilliant point on your point. But like, yeah, let our hearts break across the board.
Yeah.
But thank you for ushering us with your vulnerability into that moment of visceral feeling.
Yeah. Well, and I hope I sort of am coming at all of this, and this is going to be a strange comment, but from a place of privilege. So because really strange statement, but I was a child. It is easier for people to identify my abuse, way clearer than it is for other people. So that's a little bit of why I want to speak out as well, because I can use my story to highlight things that other people are suffering with, where they maybe don't have the privilege that I'm privy to at this point.
That's really gracious of you to use the word privilege there. You're right. Accurate use of it, but it's like, oh my, how long does it take to get to a sentence?
I know. Well, I'm saying it. I'm not sure I believe it, but yeah, I.
You, and it's really like, thank you. This is exactly the point. Ironically, power is privilege. And ironically, the whole critique of what is happening with clergy sexual abuse is like, you have been given power and privilege. And the purpose of that is for you to use it on behalf of others.
Yeah,
it's why it's such an egregious. I mean, it's just like, whoa. And here you are as a survivor being like, you don't even mean to. You're just like, I've been given privilege and privilege, I'm going to use it on behalf of others. And like, oh, of course, a survivor is teaching us this lesson.
Yeah, well, but it's because survivors understand how catastrophic this stuff is too, right? Like, no one can understand better than me how horrible it is to have your pastor sexually attack you. You come from a place of wanting to prevent that for other people because you know how horrible it is.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm like, where would you like to go next? I really want to go to the court thing. Like, there's because I'm.
Yeah.
Conversation about court, but if you want to go somewhere else first, it's fine. I'm chopping at the bit.
Yeah, no. Going towards the court stuff is great. I think explaining what happened with the youth pastor in sort of high levels will be helpful in understanding the court piece of it. So what happened when I was in I was about 14 or 15 years old in early 1995. This youth pastor had been at the church for less than a year. And he was really fun. We did lots of events and stuff like that. At some point, and I don't know who would have set this up, but there was a sleepover. I ended up sleeping over at his house. And that evening was fine. We ran errands. I slept on the couch. The next morning, his wife was not at home anymore. And I did not know that was going to happen. Bit shocked. And then he started, he wanted to take me on a quote unquote tour of his apartment. And so I had been to his apartment before. But I hadn't gone into like his bedroom, obviously, or like his office, anything like that. So he starts walking me through the different rooms and he's telling me, you know, stuff he worries or he's working on. And then he leads me into his bedroom and lies down on the bed and we're talking and I'm like thinking, I need to get out of here. I'm actually trapped and nervous. And so like in that scenario, you sort of fawn and play along with what's happening. And it ended up that he told me to lie on his shoulder and then pulled my face up towards him and started kissing me quite passionately, brought me on top of himself and was rubbing his erection against me. Same thing, fawning. I didn't know how to get out of that particular scenario, especially because it was taking place in his apartment and we were alone. It did stop. But then he went into self-protection mode. So he, the next Sunday at church, he tried to actually get out ahead of me by telling a whole bunch of people that I had kissed him, which, yeah. And I was telling people as well that we had kissed, which is sort of a gross underestimation of what had actually happened. But I, of course, as a child, couldn't process it all, couldn't figure out exactly what had happened. But he was able to, even though he was relatively new at the church, he was able to convince everybody that I was the problem, that I had sort of initiated this. Even though people knew that there had been sexual contact between this youth pastor and myself at 14, 15 years old, nobody did anything. They didn't call Children's Aid. They didn't report it to the Baptist Convention. It was just like everybody wanted to sweep it under the rug. But it, for me, had been so catastrophic. And I was just like, you just become a little bit numb and you're still moving forwards, but you're like, what is happening? Like, yeah, it was awful.
Yeah. Well, that's trauma.
Yeah.
Your kid going through public trauma with a he said, she said game.
Yeah.
And no advocates.
Right. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So it took me a really long time to figure out what had happened. I have a lot of health issues. I have extreme chronic pain. I have PTSD, depression, anxiety, all of that stemming from all of the trauma that came out of my childhood. And so I'm, as an adult, trying to figure out why do I feel so horrible? And B, like what actually did happen to me? Like to look at everything from the lens of an adult. And it took me a really long time. It was actually helpful to have my own teenagers because I'm looking at them and thinking, if any youth pastor touched them, I would be livid, like talk about mama bear. So I'm now understanding that, you know, the response from the people around me at the time of my abuse was inappropriate. And then as well through psychoanalysis, you know, I was able to, my psychotherapist is able to sort of mirror back what happened to me. And, you know, I did come to an understanding that obviously wasn't my fault and actually came to a point where I knew I had to go to the police about it.
Good. I wish going to the police was the beginning of relief.
Oh my goodness. It's not a fun thing. Not a fun thing at all. Like zero.
I'm so proud of you for getting to the place where you can name it what it was and recognize it's a thing that action needs to be taken and blah, blah, like all of that is positive. And yet I know what comes after that sentence is not good.
No, the court system is not fun. I actually felt like I did not have much of a choice about whether I went to the police or not. I wasn't really worried. So I didn't trust the court system based on my experience when I was 13.
Yeah.
Because it had failed me spectacularly. So I certainly wasn't doing it for myself. What I was worried about was that this guy, this youth pastor, had bounced from church to church to church. And so that perhaps sometime in the time it took me to figure this all out and then go to report, he could very well have hurt other people. And so that was more of my motivation in going to the police than anything really for myself.
Okay. So you've learned some things in the court system. Do you have any wisdom to drop on us? Do you want to tell us that story?
Sure. Yeah. So it's unpleasant. It's long, drawn out, and extremely unpleasant. I don't know that if somebody was asking me, I don't know that I would recommend it, but, there are bright spots in that, like, as I mentioned earlier, the validation that I got from the judge meant a lot to me. So, it wasn't all downsides, but, the court process is fairly horrible. You have very little control over anything that is happening to you. You also have very little information. You have the Crown attorney is not your lawyer. You actually don't get a lawyer for most of the proceedings. So you have nobody who's standing on your side, nobody who's feeding you any information. You're really in the dark. And then there's long periods of waiting with no information, which is kind of a painful place to be.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I have learned in speaking to so many different survivors who take so many unique paths to finding peace with their own advocacy efforts is there's no right one answer.
No.
It goes across the board. And also there's a million different reasons why someone would or would not pursue the court process.
Absolutely.
It does greet, I mean, the court process itself, I mean, you're speaking to the Canadian court process. I know the U.S. one a little bit better, but both seem equally traumatic.
Right.
Equally weighted against a survivor trying to find justice. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that grieves me is that there isn't enough conversation happening around so that survivors actually have a sense of what is your risks as you go into this? So I know that survivors generally know for themselves what they can and cannot handle and know for themselves what feels good to them. What I would say is universally, it costs you greatly to go the court route. It's a very expensive process. And I don't even mean the money part. I mean the energy and violation and even abuses that happen in there. It's very costly, but for some survivors, even if it doesn't come out with a validating response, survivors feel compelled and they know, I need to do this. I need to raise my voice in this way. I need to attempt to get this person stopped. Anyway, it's a fascinating thing to watch. The only universal thing that I have seen is that it is expensive and very costly for a survivor to travel that route. Yeah. But the motives and the outcomes are just as unique. Every case is its own unique motivated thing, and then obviously the outcome as well. Do you have any... So with that backdrop of like survivors know what they can and cannot handle and their motives are varied. Is there anything you would want to say about your experience that is just helpful? Like just put it out there.
Yeah. So I guess what's worth knowing is I did not get the reactions, the sort of PTSD reactions that I was expecting in any of this. So I sort of went in thinking it would be very similar to how when I was 13, you know, and the defense lawyer decimated me and I was hysterical. I thought it would be a lot of that sort of crying and whatnot. And that did come up in some cases early on in the process when the Crown was deciding if he was going to move forward with the case because they have to allocate resources, right? So there's no guarantee even if he's arrested. I did get scream crying and it came out of nowhere. But I think it was effective in that moment in communicating to the Crown how much of an impact this assault had had on me. And so when I went into court to testify, I was expecting the same reaction. I got next level anger. I don't know if it was kind of the mama bear part of me protecting, you know, the little girl within, but I was livid. And maybe because John was in the room as well, that might have been part of it. But yeah, it's just, it's like, you can't predict how your body is going to react. But know that it's going to do what it needs to do.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That reoccurring, trust your body, pay attention to your body. Yeah.
Yeah.
Restored Voices Collective is a survivor-led nonprofit that supports women who have been victims of adult clergy sexual abuse. We provide a safe place where ACSA survivors can find hope and pursue healing as they connect with other survivors, learn to understand their story, and reclaim their voice. If you're a survivor of ACSA, we invite you to join us at www.restoredvoicescollective.com. We're breaking the silence on adult clergy sexual abuse.
Okay, so originally when I was referencing your double abuse, I wasn't actually referencing the two abuses that you've listed here.
Okay.
I meant to reference when you raised your voice about clergy sexual abuse, you received what I consider to be abusive behavior in your disclosure process. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah. So alongside of the criminal process, I also did a lot of work in contacting the denomination. So this happened at a Baptist church. And so it's the Canadian Baptists of Ontario and Quebec that I've been dealing with. And was asking for investigations. I actually wanted them to try to make sure that he had not hurt other people by contacting other churches, because I had actually spent a lot of energy doing that myself. And it's emotionally exhausting. Should not be my job. Yeah. So I did not get fantastic responses from the CBOQ is the acronym. They still to this day are unwilling to investigate. They're leaning a little bit on the criminal conviction and saying, oh, no need to investigate because you've got this conviction. But what I'm looking for is for them to look at what happened so they can identify, like, here were the gaps and, you know, here are the new controls that we can put in place around abuse prevention. And they have made some small concessions, but they have not been willing to investigate.
Okay. So let me just repeat back to you what I think I heard you say, because even though I know the story, when you say it that concisely, I just flabbergasted. So you go and get a court judgment in your favor.
Right.
The fact that that is being just the justification for why they're not doing their part, these are grown adults. So yeah. I don't even know that much about the court system, but I understand enough to know that it's just one court case between this human and that human.
Right.
How do they not understand that their responsibility is, hey, this guy is in your midst and is interacting with more than one human being? The irresponsible is not a strong enough word. I don't even know what the strong word is.
Yeah, it's not even irresponsibility. I found what was most frustrating was like they're kind of cagey from a legal perspective. Like we sort of have to fortify ourselves as an organization. So we actually don't want to know. Because we're not actually going to communicate with you a whole lot, because the more that we say, the more open to legal liability we might be. And so we're just going to shut it down.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, I know they're not trauma-informed because I've read the communications.
Yeah, no, they're not.
So I know they're not trauma-informed, but that I don't think I understood that they were using the actual court case as justification. That should actually be the opposite. It literally should have proven to them that they have an abuser in their midst that needs to be investigated. That is such what is that? That's going to drive me crazy until I come up with the word. It is not irresponsible, but it is
not. It's negligent. It's absolutely negligent, right? Like, yeah. And in my scenario, it wasn't only the John piece that I was worried about and wanted investigated. The lead pastor, who was the lead pastor at the time of my abuse and is actually still the lead pastor at this church, did not report my abuse, not only in the 90s, but then I told him in 2020 what happened and he again did not report it. So I wanted invested. So he's being disciplined. Not that I have a whole lot of information on what that looks like. But there also needs to be an investigation around that. Like, how is it so easy for him to just, like, is it that they don't know the rules or, like, what's going on there? And it's just, yeah, you can't get any sort of answer out of them.
Well, and at the denominational level, I feel like their malpractice there, it's like, who investigates that? That is, I don't understand. How in the world do you call yourself a pastor or a pastor of pastors at the denominational level and not understand that your job is people.
Yeah.
Humans. Your job is humans. Like, I guess maybe if you define it as a rhetoric, my job is to spew rhetoric, but I don't understand how you call yourself a pastor and do not understand that the basic care and protection of humans is an assumed. That's an assumed. It's maybe not your job description, I get, but it's an assumed. How in the world can you say I am a messenger of the good news of the gospel? Oh gosh, that is
It's been infuriating. I've been lucky to have allies around me. I built a bit of an army of clergy sexual abuse experts, and thankfully so, because there is no way with some of the responses that I was getting from the CBOQ that I could have continued to pursue this myself. Like, I actually needed somebody else to fight the battle for me, because their responses are painful. And so, yeah, it really limits how much I can do on my own.
That's true. That's the thing I have also observed is there, I would say the vast majority of what I do with survivors is reverse gaslight.
Yeah.
Look at things that were gaslights, and we just start talking about how we undo that. Yep. But also the validation. I know some of your allies that you brought alongside and your advocates, and they are formidable truth tellers.
Absolutely.
And through the veneer, the shiny of like, I'm sorry.
Right. And
it is that validation of, like, it's so tragic to me that survivors are trying to raise their own voice. And it is, the vast majority of survivors have not come to Hagar's Voice simply looking for support for themselves. Almost all of them in some way, shape, or form are like, we need to help this organization change their policies. There's other things inside it. Like, it's so foul that it's falling to the survivors who are both victims of this system and also trying to advocate and have a voice inside of it. And I'm proud of you. You've done incredible work. And I love that you've gathered a team around you and they've done great things. That's true. But at the center of that is you saying, I have to protect people. It's the thing that we do.
Yeah, exactly. And this is not just a Baptist issue. This is an everywhere church issue, right? So yeah, the more that we can do to push back and force change, the better.
I would go so far as to say that if you're in a religious institution and you are not actively having a conversation about reassessing your policies and practices, I say it all the time, but policies do not keep people safe.
Right.
People keep people safe. Policies simply strike up the right conversations and help everybody come to a standard anchor point.
Yeah. But
policies do not keep people safe. So if you are not actively, if you are in a religious institution and it is not actively talking about this right now, in light of all that has come out and is been aware, I would say you are in jeopardy. That religious organization is in jeopardy. You likely have abuse happening in your midst.
Absolutely.
Time. You've mentioned to me, Alexa, the book. I just blanked on it.
Is it the Church 2 one you're thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually huge for me. So it's hashtag Church 2, written by Emily Joy Allison. And she's connected to sort of the first advocacy group that I connected with, called Into Account out of the US. And they are fabulous. I actually found that book super helpful in deconstructing my lived experience. She also does a really good job talking about how some of the theology around sexuality in general, and specific to the LGBTQ population, and how that plays into sort of creating this opportunity for so much abuse to happen. So yeah, it was a huge, fabulous resource for me.
Yeah, because I'm a little bit flabbergasted that, I think it's a record for how often I've said flabbergasted. Like, flabbergasted that churches didn't see the Me Too movement and instantly be like, oh no, if that's possible over there, that's probably possible over here. It didn't cross my mind that institutions weren't learning the same lessons that I was learning by watching the Me Too movement unfold. But there was this weird, it's not weird, I now understand it a lot better, but it was like Me Too was trekking along, but it was mm-hmm. on a different track, and religious institutions didn't seem to think it in any way, shape, or form applied to them.
Right.
So I love this concept of the church too, like, because there is no, at this point, decision makers' ignorance is now weaponized ignorance.
Yes.
You don't know the lessons that we learned, and the we is maybe a generous assumption. Mm-hmm. Don't know the lessons that we learned out of the Me Too movement and how they apply to your church. There's no excuse for that anymore. It's been too many years. It's been too many instances. It's been too proven to be in our spaces.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think Church Too is a love letter. That book is such a cool mm-hmm. bridge. Of like, yeah, we don't get to sit on our little church track and look over at the Hollywood track and be like, you guys are a hot mess.
Like, right.
No. 15 years ago, you could justify that, but we are well past that. There's no denomination or non-denomination that has been untouched by the revelations of the last 5 years. Like, so
yeah.
If you're not actively having a conversation about it, you are actively actually protecting it. It is like yep. space, and your inactivity is leaving people vulnerable.
Right. And you should be wanting to fix this problem. When you sort of evaluate the magnitude of the problem, you should want to focus on fixing it, not so much on fortifying your organization and reducing your legal liability. Like, fix the problem. We don't actually want to sue you as survivors. Like, we really don't want to sue you. But we will, if it means that that's the only way to motivate you. Like, it would just be so nice if these organizations would come out ahead of the lawsuits and show that they are really attempting to do what is right and make change.
So, Alexa, you just pointed out a super fascinating myth that I see happen all the time. Religious institutions are often mincing their words and being very guarded and not being transparent, which is a key tenet of trauma-informed care.
Yeah.
Because they want to avoid liability. That's the phrase that gets used a lot.
Yes.
If abuse is happening in your space, you are liable whether you get caught or not.
Right.
I don't understand. We, as Jesus followers, if we identify as Christians, then we understand that there is an authority above and beyond the court system who actually understands what is happening, whether we admit to it or not.
Right.
Like, if abuse is happening in our space, we are liable whether or not we get caught.
Right.
Lawyer cannot tell you whether you are liable or not. A court system does not tell you whether you are liable or not. If you are a decision maker in a religious environment and abuse happens in your space, you are liable. That is not an unforgivable sin.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that if you have decision-making powers, it is your responsibility to set up an abuse-proof organization. Yeah. And if abuse creeps its way in, you just use the same power and privilege that you had before to now make it right.
Right.
Others have out. Liability is not defined by the court system.
Right. No, that's well said. That's exactly it.
All right. So that takes you for another hour.
Yeah, I know. So much more here.
But I just need the last word. Is there anything left on the table that you'd like to say?
So I think I just want to communicate to other survivors that there are lots of us. And if you reach out, we're just so much stronger together. Know that you are not alone. These systems are horribly broken. It has nothing to do with you. There are a bunch of us that are angry, like righteous anger, table flipping anger. Like, we are working on this. So it needs to get fixed. So just, yeah, know that you're not alone, and reach out if I can be of any help. Happy to work together with other people to help reduce abuse in Christian settings.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.
For surviving, Alexa.
Thank you.
Thank you for fighting for life and truth. Thank you for raising your voice. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you for that offer here like, just thank you. We all stand with you. We're so grateful for you.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for this platform because, it's helpful to know that you have people around you that understand sort of how catastrophic clergy sexual abuse is, but then as well to have the opportunity to raise our voices, to sort of shed that shame. It's so, so important.
We need your voice. So thanks.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Ange.
Friends, thank you for using your time to honor survivors. It is incredibly encouraging to survivors and their advocates to see how many of you are leaning in. Please consider subscribing so you can bear witness to each story as it arrives on this channel. Sharing an episode is an act of solidarity. We would love for you to raise their voice on your own feeds. We honor you in your quest to abuse-proof yourself, grow your skills as an ally, and lean in with courage to live as an advocate. If we can help you in this in any way, please reach out to us at contact@hagarsvoice.com. Whether you're a survivor of clergy sexual abuse or a decision maker in a religious context, you're not alone. Special thanks to Jake Welch, our podcast producer and ally. We unabashedly invite you to consider supporting Hagar's Voice financially. Funds are used to provide things like assistance to survivors to resources they need, technology that supports things like this podcast and allows us to safely connect to and advocate for survivors, making Hagar's Voice more broadly known to survivors, and raising our collective voice to educate and inspire change. Together we rise to stop the abuse and start building a better way. So keep leaning in and join us.